Welcome to the Sigmund Cinema Podcast, where all things movie related are broken down, discussed, put back together, and discussed some more. Here's your host, Sigmund.
Hey, hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the podcast. And for today's topic, oh yeah, it's one that I could not wait for. It is one of my favorite movies. It is one of the best movies ever made. It is on numerous people's top favorite movies. And actually, we're doing two movies, but the one we're doing first is the one I'm referring to with all of these descriptions. And this movie is Back to the Future, the 1985 mega hit, directed by Robert Zemeckis, written by Zemeckis and Bob Gale, starring Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd, Leah Thompson, Thomas F. Wilson, Crispin Glover, and boy, this is where do we start? So basically, guess we'll start. I'll do a little mini review, and then I wanted to cover some I guess one of them is rather controversial, even though it's silly when it could be easily debunked. But still, as of this recording, you know, a lot of us are still locked down during the quarantine, and hey, we need something to talk about. And this is one of the subjects that came up. You know, the 35th anniversary of Back to the Future is approaching, so why not bring it back up again? And of course, the 30th anniversary of the third Back to the Future movie, Back to the Future Part 3, is approaching also. So man, we will be discussing both of those movies, and let's get to it. So Back to the Future, my personal thoughts on the movie is that like I mentioned earlier, a lot of people refer to this movie as perfect, and I agree with it. And know the difference between a favorite movie and a perfect movie, you know, movie you like. So a lot of people refer to this movie as perfect because, you know, technically there is no perfect movie. You know, you have filmmaking flaws, and a plot could be really tight, but you know, as time passed, people like to nitpick stuff, and we're gonna get to that one thing in particular about this movie, which is a huge nitpick, and I'm gonna shut that crap down immediately. But on initial viewings and subsequent viewings of Back to the Future, this seems, even with this so-called plot hole, which is a nitpick, even with that in mind, the seams of the movie don't show through. This movie is perfect. And let me say, a lot of film professors will tell you, as I've heard plenty in my younger day, the one thing you have to have airtight that's gonna pretty much guarantee that you have a decent movie or TV show or whatever piece of media that requires dialogue or direction is the script, the screenplay. And Bob Gale and Zemeckis, they really put together a tight script. So much so, I'm going to describe something that a lot of people don't notice during the movie. So anyway, my thoughts on, there is a huge amount of nostalgia with Back to the Future for me. And, you know, it's a movie I grew up with in my childhood. And, you know, as kids, when this movie came out, I was 4, maybe 3.5. But we don't care what 3-year-old, 4-year-old cares about script and acting. You know, people my age, our damn thing was the car. Look at this cool time machine that with the blue lights and flickering, and, you know, the skateboard scene was cool. And, you know, Michael J. Fox is just a lovable guy at any age. He's just a charismatic dude, and you love to watch him. Another movie that came out in 85 was Teen Wolf. And You know, Michael J. Fox was one of my favorite actors back then. But yeah, going to Back to the Future, it's a great comedy. The jokes, the humor lands, and you know, the beats. And far as let's start with the acting. I spoke with Michael J. Fox. I think Michael J. Fox was probably at the oldest. He was 25 at the time this movie came out, if I'm not mistaken. You know, he's playing a teenager. You know, obviously he's in high school. He's probably a junior or a senior, whatever. But you know, he plays the role as, you know, it comes off. You never really question it at all. You know, even at the same time he was college age on a show that was running at the same time called Family Ties. But the other awesome character in the movie, Doc Brown, played by Christopher Lloyd, and whoa, this pair is one of the most iconic pairings in movies, you think. You know, all through the 80s is when the buddy cop picture started to happen. You know, you had 48 Hours, you had the Lethal Weapons, a lot of these action movies that were having these pairings. But then you have this movie, and this is one of the more memorable pairings in the 80s. You know, with two Back to the Future movies in the 80s, Part 1 and 2, and probably one of the pairings from the 80s that gets spoke about the most is this one. So Christopher Lloyd, I spoke of, he's, if you've actually seen Christopher Lloyd in interviews, not acting, so to speak, he's very, very, he was always, even going back to when he was on Taxi, he always seemed to play a certain type of character, like really, you know, hyper and, you know, great Scott, really energetic and this and that. But you see Christopher Lloyd as a real person, and he's very soft-spoken, very quiet when he talks, and you know, it speaks to how good of an actor he is. I don't think Christopher Lloyd gets the credit as an actor that he deserves. You know, you see him in his Doc Brown character, three movies, and his Fester Adams character in the two Adams Family movies. And even though those characters are night and day, he still carries that certain hyper energy. And a lot of people just assume that's the way Christopher Lloyd is, and he's actually not. So anyway, no, I think the movie, you know, the movie is about a young teenager who goes back in time in a time machine that a buddy of his built. He accidentally goes back in time, and he accidentally puts in the chain of events of his parents not meeting. Therefore, it's going to cause the chain of effects of himself not existing, and he has to fix that. So he has to find some way to hook his dad up with his mom. And at the same time, his mom met him because he intervened in the meeting of his parents. She met him, and she has a crush on him. And that brings us to the topic that is the reason why a lot of movie studios back in the day passed on the movie. Movie studios like Disney, I believe Fox passed on it, Columbia, which is Sony now. And Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale really had to shop the script out. And you know, it's the incest factor really was disturbing to a lot of people who read the script, and that just stuck out to them. But you know, Universal took a chance on it. And I go back to that awesome screenplay by Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale. It's so well paced. The dialogue is so sharp, and the movie doesn't gloss over the subject. You know, it's brought up a couple of times in the movie, but it handles it in such a way where it's not as creepy as it could have been. And, you know, you got to give credit to Bob Gale and Zemeckis for writing that screenplay that way so it wouldn't come off as creepily as it could have. But no, there you have it. So, yeah, in this movie, it holds up in a lot of ways. 35 years ago, and the special effects, nowadays we have HD, hell, we got 4K, you know, HDR, Dolby 10 vision and stuff like that. And the visuals on this movie surprisingly hold up very well. And keep in mind, people, there's a difference between something looking phony visual effects wise and then you not, well, there's a difference between something looking phony and you can tell that it's not real. You know, of course, there's obvious shots in the movie that you know aren't real. You know, it's a damn 35-year-old movie. But it's obviously a visual effect. But this movie comes from the age of, you know, old school visual effects. There was no traditional CGI the way it exists today. No modern style CGI. Everything was, you had matte paintings, optical printed visual effects, you know. And this movie, surprisingly, was not nominated for best visual effects, which is a huge surprise. I'll come back to that and check up on who the actual nominees were that year for visual effects. That's very surprising to me. And you know what, yeah, I'm right here. So there were three nominees for visual effects for in 1986 for the movies that came out in 85. There was Cocoon, which was the winner. There was Young Sherlock Holmes, and there was Return to Oz. It's interesting. Usually there are five movies in the visual effects category, but for some reason it was knocked down to three this year. But yeah, Back to the Future was not nominated. And heck, while we're on the subject, it won one Oscar, Best Sound Effects Editing. And it was nominated for two more. Best Screenplay by Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, which I've mentioned a lot in the short period. Best Sound. And we're going to get on this one and segue into a snub. So Best Original Song, The Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News. Great freaking song. And for those of you that don't know, this was actually Huey Lewis's first foray into writing a song for a movie. Technically he didn't turn it down. He said to the producers, he had a meeting, I think, with Spielberg, Robert Zemeckis, and Bob Gale. He said, I can't make a song named Back to the Future. They had the title by then. So they said, no, you could do whatever you want, and we'll give you some ideas to go off of. And he wrote The Power of Love. And here it is. It was nominated for an Oscar. It lost, but it was a well-deserved nomination. Who did it lose to? Knowing the Academy Awards, it probably lost to a song we don't even think about anymore. Yeah, it lost to a song called "Say You, Say Me." Okay, I'll give them this one. Lionel Richie for the movie White Nights. All right, yeah. And it's funny, I think around that time Lionel Richie and Huey Lewis would work together on the We Are the World song. Yeah, that's funny. So since we're on the Academy Award Oscars topic, I want to talk about a tremendous snub, one of the biggest snubs, hell, I'm gonna say it, of all time. I'm talking about this fantastic score to the movie. This bombastic, epic orchestra score by Alan Silvestri. It's one of the most recognizable pieces of music in existence in any form of media. It's even when you don't even have to hear the actual score. That little noise that happens when the movie comes on, you know what I'm talking about. But even just hearing that, you know what you're about to hear next. And you know, those booming trumpets and how this movie was not nominated for Best Original Score is beyond me. You know, speaking of Alan Silvestri, you know, he's still a prolific composer today. He's mostly known nowadays for the Avengers movies, Endgame and Infinity War, which were great scores in their own right. But yeah, so, you know, fantastic movie. Back to the Future was it holds up. It's just but anyway, let's get to the nitty-gritty, god doggone. This so-called plot hole that people like to bring up, that isn't a plot hole, it's a nitpick, but let's get to it. So in the movie, Marty McFly poses as Calvin Klein, and he has to hook up his father and his mother, or he will disappear from existence. He will be erased from his existence. Excuse me. Tried to do the line in Doc Brown voice. But anyway, the so-called plot hole is, why doesn't his parents remember him 30 years later? Why don't his parents recognize, hey, our son looks a lot like that guy from 30 years ago? Okay. So, is that a plot hole? Okay, in my humble opinion, no. But outside of my opinion, objectively, no. It's not a plot hole. And I'm explaining why. It's so surprising to me that people think this is a plot hole. So, 30 years, man, 30 years. So, Marty McFly as Calvin Klein in 1955 was only there for a week. Actually, yeah, he was there for about a week. And keep in mind the timeline. He probably only interacted with his parents for less than a week. So, he gets there. Remember, he runs into his dad. He chases his dad and gets hit by the car, and then he meets his mother because he's knocked out cold. So, and then he runs into Doc, and he spends probably the whole day with Doc. So that's one day that he's not in the school, and they go to the school the next day. Even before that, he arrives at 1955 at night, and then it's actually early morning going into the day. So anyway, so he goes on his mission to try and hook up his parents together. So he spends most of the time with George McFly and a little bit of time with his mother. So anyway, he finally gets his parents together. So here we are about the plot hole. Why doesn't his parents remember him? One, who said that they don't remember him? Hey, I'm pretty sure sometime within those, well, not 30 years, but I'm sure, let's say Marty McFly is 18. Let's say he's 17. So he's only going to look how he looked when they met him in 1955 and his teenage years. All right, let's give it 14, 15, 16, 17. Let's give it 4 years, 14 to 18. You know, it probably a subconscious thought crossed the parents' mind, like, hey, he looks a little bit like somebody we knew. But the thing is, you know, people are saying it's a plot hole. So a thing like memory can't really be attributed as a plot hole. We all know people who can't remember where they left their damn car keys. You know, we know people that don't remember, you know, some of their family's names that they haven't seen in a couple of years. You're telling me it's a plot hole because two people don't remember a guy that they only interacted with for about 5 days over 30 years ago? Come on, that's not a plot hole. And some people would just excuse it. Hey, I remember what happened to me when I was in elementary school. It was special. Good for you. You have a good memory. But because you have a good memory, that doesn't mean a movie has a plot hole because somebody else can't remember like you do. You know what I'm saying? And look at all of the things that could have happened to George and Lorraine McFly from 1955 to 1985. Okay, Marty is the youngest of their three children. Okay, let's go on stuff we know for sure that happened. So that night, they kissed. Boom. Calvin Klein, aka Marty McFly, he's out of the picture. They are in love. You know. So from 1955 to 1985, sadly, they get married. That's a huge event. They have a child. They have another child. Then they have another child. Those are four major events in their life between 1955 and 1985. Some little twerp named Calvin that, you know, he's not really important. You know what I'm saying? So no, that's not how plot holes work. The definition of a plot hole, it doesn't even attribute to, you know, how it doesn't. No, it's not a plot hole. It's not, and that's not it's not an opinion. Because some people have a good memory, some people don't. And I'm gonna address the thing people do like to defend what they think is the plot hole with. Yeah, it was a major event. Oh, I forgot one more thing that happened that night of the Enchantment Under the Sea dance, the big freaking historic storm that killed the clock tower. So yeah. So man, remember, hey Lorraine, remember that night? Even Lorraine even says in 1985 at the beginning of the movie, she, you know, that's the night we fell in love. That's the night I knew. And even back then when Marty interfered, you know, that still happened. She still fell in love with George. Even more so because he defended her honor. Then they danced and they had to kiss. You know? Yeah, of course they spoke to Marty as Calvin, you know, before he left to go back to the future. Mm-hmm. And that was it. You know? So no, that is not a plot hole. The end. So anyway, yeah, if this is, the movie is definitely worth revisiting. It's definitely worth, if you have it on DVD, it's definitely worth buying on Blu-ray. If you have it on Blu-ray, it's definitely worth buying on 4K Blu-ray. You know, I think I own this movie probably 6 or 7 times over. You know, VHS, a couple of times on that format. DVD, Blu-ray, yeah, and the 4K isn't out yet, but trust me, I definitely will. But yeah, plenty of people refer to Back to the Future as the perfect movie. This, you know, is damn near flawless. And one more thing I wanted to touch on to speak to how, you know, that perfect movie title that a lot of people like to give it. One more thing I like to speak on is Marty McFly, the character himself in the first movie. The movie around him is so tight, it's so well structured that we don't even realize that Marty McFly himself doesn't have a character arc. Think about that. Marty McFly himself is the perfect character. He has no flaws. He has no character arc. He is the same person he is at the end of the movie that he was at the beginning. He affects everything that goes on around him in the movie, but he himself has no character arc. And we'll touch on this when I talk about Back to the Future 3 in a couple of minutes. This is one of the main reasons why they added something to his character, and I'll speak about that in the Back to the Future 3 segment of the podcast. But yeah, the movie is so great. People don't even realize that. Like, wow. Everybody else has an arc except for Marty McFly himself. And that's kind of amazing that the movie is so, it's so perfect, you know, can't use any other word, that you don't even realize that this as a flaw, because technically it's not a flaw, but it's something very interesting. If you know anything about screenwriting, you know how major characters or leading characters are supposed to be written. And you know, Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis actually didn't realize this till after the movie was released. Like, wow, we wrote the perfect character, and the perfect character ended up in one of the rare perfect movies. You know, you just don't usually see that anymore. So my last thoughts on Back to the Future, the 1985 classic, is you just don't see this type of filmmaking anymore. As far as you can see, all, you know, you can see, and I'm not even gonna get on the Eric Stoltz situation, because, you know, that's kind of messed up, kind of sad. And even with that, you know, they really wanted to make this movie that didn't work out, and they went back and they basically remade the same movie with another actor, and it still, you know, it still came out the way it did, which was to be excellent. So this is me, my opinion on the movie. It is a 5-star movie. It holds up with each subsequent viewing, and it's a great comedy, it's a great rom-com. You know, it touches on bullying, which a lot of movies in the 80s, you know, give credit, a lot of movies in the 80s did, they touched on the bullying subject. But yeah, it's just a fantastic movie. You know, I'm pretty sure I can't say anything that you haven't heard about the movie already. So yeah, definitely, you know, a lot of us are still in quarantine as of this recording. You know, by the time this is released, hopefully we're a little bit back to normal. But yeah. So anyway, that's Back to the Future. That's my little mini review, my little analysis, the debunking of that non-plot hole. Yeah. And feel welcome. My Instagram, I'm gonna shout it out a couple more times, at Sigma Cinema. You're welcome to, you know, debate me on that. Yeah, it's pointless because you'll lose. But no, just kidding. But seriously, if you want to, you can. But yeah, so that is Back to the Future. We're going to take a little break, and we're coming back with the 30th anniversary discussion of Back to the Future Part 3. And a lot of interesting things to say about that movie. So stick with me. I'll be back. And listen to this. Hey, everybody, welcome back. Now we are going to get to the 30th anniversary of the third film in the Back to the Future trilogy, Back to the Future Part 3, the 1990 movie written and directed by Robert Zemeckis, co-written by Bob Gale. And Back to the Future Part 3 is very interesting. The legacy of the movie, I guess, so to speak, because so we all know Back to the Future Part 1, which we just previously discussed, the time traveling element of the movie, it was used a couple of times. That's it sent Marty McFly back to 1955, and he spends the whole movie trying to get back to his present time, 1985. Okay, Back to the Future Part 2 does something very interesting. It jumps to the future, then back to the past, then back again. So it's very interesting, because the filmmakers, they toy with the time traveling concept, and what the character of Doc Brown always referred to, you know, messing up the space-time continuum. So Back to the Future Part 3, it kind of goes back to the roots of Part 1. So the movie starts out in 1955, when Marty from Part 2, he comes from the alternate 1985 to fix the problem that happened back in 1955. And, you know, something happens. Doc from 1985 gets sent back to 1885. So Marty needs the help from 1955 Doc to go back to the Old West. So, and for the whole movie, what I mean by Back to the Future Part 3 goes back to the first movie's roots. It stays in one particular time period for almost the entire movie, trying to get back to the original time, which is basically what the first movie did. So a lot of people initially didn't like that the movie did that. They really liked what Part 2 did, that it jumped from one time to the next and to the next and went back again. So I kind of think, for lack of a better term, people were spoiled by Part 2. And you got to remember, Part 3 came out less than a year after the second movie. The movies were shot back to back with a 2 or 3 week break in between the filming of both movies. So they were almost, definitely made back to back. I was going to say simultaneously, but that's not true. So I think the short period of time between the two sequels lent how people felt about Part 3 initially. And also, it's very interesting because Part 3 falls into the subgenre of a Western. Yeah, that's right. So Part 3 is technically, it's a legit Western. You know what, it pokes fun at the Western genre, but at the end of the day, the movie itself is technically a Western. And you know what, over the years, people have grown to appreciate it as a Western, which is very interesting. And yeah, we would definitely discuss that more on. But and you know what, I guess I'll bring this up now. More people, I guess, as the years have passed, actually, there's a decent amount of people who actually like Part 3 more than Part 2. And that's a discussion worth having. Me personally, I'm one of those people. Now, when I say I like Part 3 more than 2, that doesn't mean I don't like Part 2 at all, because that's just not true. Part 2 is a tremendous, you know, middle part of a trilogy, and it bridges the trilogy very well. So Part 3 is, I think its strength is, you know, what the strength with Part 1 was. Is it gets into the time period, and it's focused in that time period. And what I mean by focused is, it gives the characters time to develop. And what Part 3, other than a Western, what Part 3 becomes is a romantic movie in sorts. So yeah, Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, they do a lot of interesting things with Back to the Future Part 3. And the romantic element is actually one of the strongest elements of the movie. The relationship between Emmett Brown, you know, Doc Brown, and Clara, who's played by Mary Steenburgen, is actually a very involving and pretty legit romance subplot. And trivia for you people out there who are fans of Christopher Lloyd, this is Christopher Lloyd's first on-screen kiss anywhere, which is very interesting. So, and you got to realize, at this point in time, I think Christopher Lloyd was 60, if I'm not mistaken. No, he was probably in his 50s. No, actually, he wasn't 60. He was 51. Interesting. But yeah, still at 51, he's been acting up to that point still for a very long time, and it's his first kiss. But anyway, yeah, so Back to the Future Part 3. It has, I don't think cult following is the appropriate term, because the movie itself was a box office hit. But I'm going to use the term underappreciated. So yeah, people for a lot of years, they hung on, of course, the first Back to the Future and Back to the Future Part 2. And you know, Back to the Future Part 2, it threw a lot at us. A lot of interesting visual effects, you know, the kids, we in particular, you know, at that time we loved it because it had the hoverboards, of course, the DeLorean, the time machine, and, you know, the bunch of time traveling. And also, which is also in Back to the Future Part 3, we have multiple versions of people that exist, actors playing multiple roles. But yeah, so anyway, going back to the Future Part 3, I want to talk about performances. So, going back to Christopher Lloyd as Doc Brown, I think this is the best performance in the movie. And, you know, Christopher Lloyd, I mentioned in Back to the Future Part 1, you know, we're used to seeing Christopher Lloyd as playing eccentric type of hyper characters and this and that, and we get to see him play down his Emmett Brown, his Doc Brown character, a bit when the romance subplot kicks in. And it's very interesting to see the way he handles, you know, falling in love with the Clara character. And it's you know, it's quite a sight to see when you go back and you analyze it. You're like, wow, he's, you know, you're actually seeing for the first time the Doc Brown character be expanded, being developed even more. So, and that brings me to, since we're talking performances, the second best performance in a movie. And I think throughout the entire trilogy, you know, a lot of people like this character throughout all three of the movies, but if I'm not mistaken, this is knowledge coming off the top of my head. And the character I'm talking about is Biff, or in this movie, Buford Mad Dog Tannen. You know, Thomas F. Wilson, the character he plays, the Tannen, different variations of the Tannen character throughout all three movies. And I believe the factor that I was getting to, Thomas F. Wilson is the actor who had the most different makeup changes throughout all three of the movies. And with that, you know, he has the most variations of playing multiple characters. And I think he does a great job with the Mad Dog character, you know, because you're not just looking, because he's not Biff. You know, he's Mad Dog. It's a whole different character. And, you know, Thomas F. Wilson does an excellent job. I don't think he gets enough credit for his performances throughout the trilogy, but especially in this movie. So yeah, I wanted to definitely tip my hat off to that, to Thomas F. Wilson playing the Mad Dog character. So, anywho, I'm going back to I guess I could call it the criticism. You know, a lot of people, like I said, a lot of people in general, this was a big risk that the filmmakers took, and that being, a lot of people in general don't like Westerns. You know, that's some of the best movies ever made are Westerns. But your average moviegoer, they, for some reason, just don't dig it. There's a stigma of Westerns being boring. You know, that's probably the biggest one that's on the Western genre. And, you know, you automatically, that sticks out when people, it was a cowboy movie and blah, blah, blah. But like I said, it is easily not true. You know, there's a lot of exciting, fast-paced Westerns, and there's, you know, Westerns is a main genre, but there are sub-genres that, you know, fall under Westerns, and vice versa. And the vice versa is, in this case, this is, you know, Western is a sub-genre of this, you know, sci-fi adventure movie. So, yeah, that's, but anywho, I mentioned something back in, a little while ago in the Back to the Future 1 review or analysis, that Michael J. Fox, his Marty McFly character in the first movie, was a perfect character. And what I meant by that, elaborating on that, is that his character had no flaws. His character also was the same person at the end of the movie that he was at the beginning of the movie. And Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale realized this. I mentioned, aforementioned, they realized that, and they're like, wow. They were actually surprised that they got away with it, you know. And that was very easy to do because they wrote such a great script. But anyway, in the sequels, the second and the third movie, they added that he was a hothead. In the second movie, it was you know, when people called him out, and it was Chicken specifically. And in the third movie, this movie, Back to the Future 3, people calling him, what are you, yellow? Is that he loses his temper, and that and playing off in the second movie, when he loses his temper, he causes an event that would affect the rest of his basically the rest of his life. He caused a car accident, and part three comes back to that. So they make his character, the Marty McFly character, more realistic by giving him a flaw, which is, you know, it's pretty decent. Excuse me. So yeah, and going back to the Western genre, what does every Western usually have? A shootout. And this is what when you invest yourself into a trilogy or into a series of movies, filmmakers usually set stuff up in one movie and they pay it off in a subsequent one. So in Back to the Future Part 2, the alternate 1985 Biff character is watching a cowboy movie, a Western movie, with Clint Eastwood. And I forget what the movie was. But anywho, it pays itself off in Back to the Future Part 3 because Marty McFly, you know, he sneaks in and he sees the movie that Biff is watching. But you know, little stuff like that is rewarding. And yeah, basically, and I'm sorry about that. So the movie Biff is watching is a Fistful of Dollars, and in the movie, the Clint Eastwood character has a makeshift bulletproof vest. And like I said, in Back to the Future Part 3, this comes back into play. So, and one thing that this that the Back to the Future movies are consistently good at throughout is the humor. And you have to give it to like all directors who write their own movies aren't the best screenwriters. You know, I discussed this. There's another episode coming out that or should be out already, that we discussed this, that some directors aren't great screenwriters and vice versa. You know, there are some filmmakers that are great at both, but not a lot. But yeah, the humor in the Back to the Future movies are consistent and good throughout. You know, one of the funnier elements in the movie, like with the first movie, Marty McFly, he adopts the name Calvin Klein, you know, the famous fashion designer. And in this movie, he adopts the name I mentioned, Clint Eastwood. So, of course, in 1885, nobody's heard of that name. And, you know, the actual Clint Eastwood gave the joke his blessing and gave him, you know, with that permission to use it. And it's quite funny. You know, and there's a little funny scene in the mirror where Marty McFly is doing a "you talking to me" bit. You know, at that point, it probably wasn't as overdone as it is today. You know, it was 30 years ago. So, yeah. And but basically, you know, going to a little bit of trivia here. So I mentioned a few actors playing multiple characters throughout the series. And one character throughout all of the movies is Strickland, and played by James Tocan. And in this movie, Back to the Future 3, his descendant is Marshall James Strickland. And James Tocan, you know, playing the same character. He's playing his ancestor or whatever. And it's very interesting. So at the end of the movie, after the gunfight between Tannen and Marty, Tannen, Mad Dog Tannen, gets arrested by the deputy. And you don't immediately ask the question, what happened to the marshal, Strickland? And in a deleted scene, a very, very disturbing deleted scene, and rightfully so, I'm surprised they even filmed this scene. So Tannen actually kills Marshall Strickland. It's in front of his son, which is nuts. You know, it's a very, even in his raw format, you know, it's a very emotional and disturbing scene. I'm glad that they cut that. But yeah, that's a little piece of trivia. So what's my take on Back to the Future Part 3? As I mentioned earlier, I think it is the better movie of the sequels as far as top to bottom, movie wise, you know, script, acting, the entertainment. And probably I would give the overall entertainment factor to the second movie, which is funny, even though I like the third movie better. But yeah, this yeah, I have to give it to the third movie. I think it's the better between the sequels of the series. So what is what's the legacy of the Back to the Future trilogy? But that's pretty damn simple. Even with the first movie, is pretty damn historic, you know. This is a very strong trilogy from top to bottom. Bob Gale and Zemeckis said that this movie will never be remade, never be rebooted, and they actually control the rights to the movie. So Universal can't snatch it, can't go without them and do it. They legally can't do it. So people who don't like remakes, you know, you don't need to worry, because it's not gonna happen. And if goodness forbid anything happens to Zemeckis or Bob Gale, their estates will control the rights for that. And I believe Zemeckis had said something about it wouldn't even happen then, when he's long gone. So yeah. And you know, when it comes to remakes and reboots, some movies don't need them. But we're in an era now where it's popular for these movie studios to leech. I don't know if that's fair, but no, I guess it's only fair. I guess it's a fair phrase. But yeah, leech. A lot of these studios, they like to leech and take advantage of nostalgia. And they just want to. One company that's doing it is Disney, with these live action remakes, these half-assed live action remakes. You know, it's all about the dollar, you know. But there are some filmmakers out there who genuinely want to make a great movie, be it a remake or a sequel or whatever. But for the most part, these remakes are hastily put together just to grab a few bucks. But we do not need to worry about that with Back to the Future. So thank goodness. But the legacy of this movie is something amazing. You know, I don't have any children yet, but great friends of mine have 8 and 10 year olds who know what Back to the Future is, and you know what Marty is. And you have Ricky and Morty, the Ricky and Morty cartoons. Come on, that's obviously Family Guy, with his multiple references to Back to the Future. It's very, you know, even before the anniversaries, it has its place in pop culture. And it's definitely not going anywhere. Speaking of Back to the Future 3, which, you know, is the topic here as we speak, I believe out of all the cars that they made, only 3 survived. And I think one is actually on Universal has one. It's probably not on the lot, but it's probably in a warehouse somewhere. And there's another one in a private collection, and there's one in a museum. Now, I wanted to talk about the one in the private collection because, boy, somebody, just a regular citizen who, well off, he spent $500,000 on the original, on one of the original Back to the Future 3 cars. And as you know, you can tell all three of the cars apart. They're very easily identifiable between the cars in the first and second or third movie. This one had the big, you know, the white wall wheels with the silver thingy in the middle, and all of the gadgets on top of the hood. So yeah, somebody dished out $500,000 But it's this freaking DeLorean. And yeah, that's freaking amazing to me. But you know, you can't put a price on, you know, nostalgia and what it means to you, you know, whoever you are. Some people think that's freaking nuts to spend that much money, but to the guy who spent the money, this is priceless. And this is the type of legacy that this movie, the type of impact this trilogy has on people. And I think that's quite an amazing thing. You know, we're concentrating, you know, going back to Back to the Future Part 2, Robert Zemeckis started a horrible rumor that the hoverboards were real. I was one of the goofy kids who believed it and went to Toys R Us, had my parents drag me all over town. They didn't know any better. So yeah, Back to the Future Part 1, 35th anniversary. If by some crazy reason you haven't seen this movie, I don't know why you wouldn't have by now. Go buy it. It's a movie, you know, go buy the trilogy. And by the time this episode is out, the 4K versions should be released. But if you don't have a 4K player, just, you know, buy the DVD or the regular Blu-ray. And I mean physical copy. You should own this in your collection that you could pluck out and watch anytime you want to, you know. But yeah, that's, you know, Back to the Future Part 3. I guess I'll give my final rating on that movie. It's a great, like I said, it's an actual legit good Western. Great romance story. I don't know if you would identify it as a rom-com. No, I don't think so. No, but it does have a good romantic subplot in it with Doc Brown and the Clara character. And, you know, the movie, I recently discussed another trilogy. I know I'm gonna say it, the Star Wars sequel trilogy. And, you know, the last movie, Rise of Skywalker, left you with a really, I wouldn't say half empty feeling. It left you with a half empty feeling, you know, like, man, but that was a very disjointed trilogy. But Back to the Future 3 wraps up everything great. There's no need for Back to the Future 4. If there was, it'd be forced and just be a cash grab. Like I've mentioned before, that's not happening. But it wrapped up everything fantastically, you know, and visually and storytelling wise, and with the train and everything, you know, it was sort of sad to see the DeLorean get destroyed. You know, that's we had some great memories with that car in all of these three movies. But yeah, everything is wrapped up in a nice bow. And you know, it's sad to see that it ended, but it, you know, it's great to have it end so well. And that's yeah, so Back to the Future, you could buy the movies and trilogy sets, you could buy them separately, I believe. But yeah, this is a very awesome set of movies. And oh yeah, I didn't get my final rating for Back to the Future Part 3. Yeah, I'll give it 4 stars out of 5. Definitely. It's very rare, like I mentioned, a Star Wars sequel trilogy. I don't hate it, but it's very rare that a trilogy wraps up real nice, with the third movie being better than the middle movie. No, in my opinion, that's strictly an opinion. But wrapping up here, I hope you enjoyed the show. If you have any questions or requests, you want to hop on the podcast and have a little debate about the so-called plot hole from the first movie, oh, you are more than welcome. But I warn you, don't do it. Don't do it. But no, anyway, I want to thank you all for listening. Go back and check out some of the episodes if you haven't heard them. And if you have heard them, hey, go back and listen again. You probably missed something. But my Instagram is @SigmundCinema, and check it out. Drop those requests. And until next time, be safe. And be excellent to each other. Until next time.